And welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University. Tonight's discussion is on issues and challenges facing humanitarian aid and development assistance in today's world. Speaking will be Janina Ochojska, president and founder of the Polish Humanitarian Organization, and Larry Cox, senior program officer, Human Rights and International Cooperation Unit, Ford Foundation. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Tonight's discussion is on the future of humanitarian aid. And I'm particularly happy to introduce to you two truly exceptional speakers, exceptional people. Janina Ochojska, president and founder of the Polish Humanitarian Organization, and Larry Cox, senior program officer at the Human Rights and International Cooperation Unit at the Ford Foundation. They will discuss the issues and challenges facing humanitarian aid and development assistance in today's world, including the political dilemmas faced by humanitarian organizations and the criticisms leveled at them. They will be also speaking about the state of human rights movements and their future. I would like to say a few words about the speakers. Janina Ochojska is president of the Polish Humanitarian Organization, which she founded in 1994, following a trip to war-torn Bosnia with a French humanitarian convoy. The Polish Humanitarian Organization was the first such organization created in Eastern Europe. And its objective was to help victims of war, of natural disasters, and severe poverty in, among other places, Kazakhstan, Kosovo, Chechnya, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It also runs aid programs to help children in need in Poland. For her work, Janina Ochojska has received several awards, including in 1993, if I'm not mistaken, the European Woman of the Year title from the European Commission. She writes frequently about humanitarian issues and was recently named one of 10 women of the world by Marie Claire magazine. Larry Cox, who works at the Ford Foundation, his work focuses on international human rights issues and international justice and on advancing economic, social, cultural, and human rights in the United States. Prior to his role in the Ford Foundation, Mr. Cox was for 5 years executive director of the Rainforest Foundation, an international organization that works with indigenous peoples in the Brazilian Amazon to protect their land and rights. He worked for Amnesty International for 14 years, holding a number of positions, including communications director, director of the program against the death penalty, and deputy director of Amnesty International USA. They will be speaking for approximately half an hour each. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for inviting me to visit your university and to share with you some of my reflection on humanitarian aid. It is my intention to present to you the 10 principles of humanitarian aid that my organization adopted in order to make our help constructive, not destructive. It is my opinion that without these rules, helping is merely a waste of funds and serves only to ease our minds rather than to help those who, when deprived of our aid, will leave their homes in panics or watch their families die of hunger or war. Many times I have watched the tragedy of other human beings from up close and wondered why we were so ineffective. In 2000, when the Declaration of Millennium Development Goals was signed at the United Nations Summit, we, the rich countries, undertook to minimize hunger and poverty, to provide education to children, to develop equal access to health care, to combat the terrible AIDS disease, to protect the environment, and finally, to develop a global partnership for development. What of the things have we done to the poorest? Later that year in Nice, the world adopted a Charter of Fundamental Rights due to each and every person. Let me quote just three of them. Article 1. Human dignity is inviolable. It must be respected and protected. Article 2.1. Everyone has the right to life. Article 24.1. Children shall have the right to such protection and care as is necessary for their well-being. I strongly identify with these values contained in these declarations, and they delineate all aspects of dignity of human life. I can state that all the people gathered there, myself included, enjoy the inviolability, of their rights, and that we personally are far removed from the threat of humiliating life in the slums or death of starvation or thirst. However, are all people on earth in a similarly comfortable situation? What kind of a world are we dealing with today? 22,000 people in this world die of hunger per day. 1,500 pregnant women a day dies due to a lack of proper care. Today, another 6,000 children will die because of no access to drinking water. 20% of the inhabitants of this planet live for under $1 per day. Every fifth child in the world does not go to school. And 11 million children die annually of disease. They are perfectly curable, and many countries are devastated by wars and ethnic purges, and in others, people suffer under totalitarian system. Doesn't it insult human dignity? Doesn't it insult our dignity? With this knowledge in mind, can we go on peacefully? What with our conscience? Let us look on the world we have created and at the future we have prepared for the coming generations. What shall we do then? How can we effectively prevent people from dying of hunger and thirst? How can we change the world so as to ensure that everyone has equal opportunities to live and develop in one's own culture, enjoying dignity and independence? It seems that the world has developed a powerful tools for that purpose, among them humanitarian and development aid. Backed up by a multitude of lofty declarations and organizations, equipped with enormous funds and the services of grand numbers of more or less dedicated people. The recent tsunami disaster has shown how generous we can be. Exactly 1 year before the tsunami, the world was shocked by the tragedy in Bam in Iran. Today, 1 year after the disaster, only 5% of houses have been rebuilt. People are still living in tents. And the lucky ones have pre-made houses of 16 square meters and a roof of metal sheets. The people have lost hope. They can see no future, and the help that flowed so generously has disappeared somewhere along the way. When I examine yet another effects of the aid provided, I can see that instead of bringing about positive changes, the help shatters the fundaments of existence of the receiving nations. In Afghanistan, free food deliverers undermine the rapidly growing local farming. In Kosovo, 2 years after the intervention, the water supply system and the electric network still didn't function. In camps for refugees from Rwanda, the food provided is traded for weapons. Yet again, a persisting mistake is repeated. Where the effects of temporary aid are made permanent. On seeing all that, I am ever more convinced that changes have to be introduced to the way we provide humanitarian aid. The world's public opinion should insist on reforming the system of aid to war and disaster victims. I will proceed now to a brief overlook of the Ten Commandments that I mentioned earlier. Without the compliance with these rules, I cannot possibly imagine bringing humanitarian aid based on moral principles and preservation on human dignity. Point one, let us show solidarity. Aid is an expression of solidarity with those in need, which helps to build a civic society on the part of both the donors and the recipients. Thanks to the solidarity of those providing help, we are able to gather means for a specific purpose, and the awareness of that purpose and the willingness to participate help to build a civic society. Our participation in the organization of assistance not only necessitates the involvement of beneficiaries, but it should also contain elements of building a civic society, such as gathering beneficiaries around a given problem, joint realization, capitalization on local experience. Overall, I think that we as people are unified and generous, but only when it comes to mass media tragedies. This was the case with September 11, the tsunami tragedy, or the earthquake disaster in Bam in December 2004, for whose victims the entire world collected money. But the tragedies in Darfur, in Western Sudan, or in Rwanda happened quietly because they were related to politics. Can we speak of solidarity when 2 days after the beginning of Tutsi massacre, there appeared in Niamata a convoy of United Nations transporters which collected all Europeans, 5 priests and 2 nuns. The Swiss nuns wanted to take Tutsi nuns with them. The soldiers told them that their place was in Rwanda. The Tutsi nuns died shortly after, and on 21st April, with the massacre raving, the Security Council reduced the number of United Nations soldiers in Rwanda from 2,500 to 270. So what is the smallest thing that we can do? How can we express our solidarity? My answer is by knowing. Unfortunately, we are usually little aware of the real picture of the world and the resulting obligations that we have towards the poorest. And yet, each and every one of us is responsible for what is going on in the world, including us gathered here. The understanding of that is especially important as it raises our awareness and the will to bring help. Point two. Let us share and let us respect each other. Assistance should bring people together. It should mean real sharing instead of distributing goods the people do not need. The aid we provide needs to respect and support human dignity instead of crushing it. The victims of conflicts and disaster on simply the impoverished should be perceived as fully entitled citizens and not merely victims or charity cases. Let us consider the plastic sheets that serve as stands to 500,000 IDPs. They are internal displaced persons in camps in Sri Lanka. Tents that are too hot during the day and too wet in the night because of the pouring rain that gets in. Is that the kind of help that respects the dignity of those people and constitutes an example of sharing? Is the dignity of those people and the respect for their future not enough to help them to return to their homes and villages? Point three, beneficiaries can do it themselves. The social structures which form the fundamentals for the later proper functioning of the entire community should be reinforced as early as at the emergency stage of assistance. I think we all agree that the beneficiaries should be involved in the assistance already at the emergency stage and then engaged in the planning and realization on various activities. However, when it comes to another crisis, the organizations give in to the subliminal temptation of technocratic behavior, which tells them that they can to do it better and quicker than themselves, replacing the recipients in activities they can do perfectly well themselves. Or the excessive use of foreign workers and volunteers result in crushing the local initiative. In 1999 in Albania, where over 400,000 people from Kosovo found refuge, I witnessed a scene where foreign volunteers were brought to do simple works in setting up camps, graveling the paths, and the idle refugees looked on. A person once accustomed to receiving help, though insufficient, will always remain dependent upon the assistance of international organizations. In camps in Sudan, Sri Lanka, Chechnya, there are millions of people that remain idle because they have been cut off from their workshops. And this is the real problem. However, if the refugees were involved from the very start in the management over the camp, maintenance of order, or the organization of healthcare and education, they would be better prepared for the future takeover of such tasks. What is more, they would learn new modes of work, gain trust in aid organizers, and foster their own initiative. Point four, let us not increase anarchy. Cooperation with local and state authorities is indispensable for the effective functioning of a humanitarian organization. Such cooperation is fundamental for mutual education. It also strengthens the sense of responsibility on the part of local authorities for the communities they are due to serve. When we started our mission in Sri Lanka, we saw organizations responsible for water treatment make great efforts to clean 40 meters deep wells, which even after double or triple treatment, still filled up with salt water. Tsunami wave was so powerful that it forced salt water into ground waters. This process can only be reversed by heavy rainfall, and anyway, it will take up at least 2 years, as we were told by the people from the Water Resources Board at the Ministry of Agriculture in Colombo. They were overjoyed to be finally approached by some international organization, as they have hydrologists, geologists, and equipment on site. They now help us in the Ampara region, hardest hit by tsunami, where we are drilling 70 meters deep wells that reach clean drinkable water. This example shows that without the cooperation with local specialists and structures, our work is often an ineffective waste of money. In Kačani commune in Kosovo, I saw the effects of a lack of cooperation between the administration of the United Nations mission in Kosovo and local administration. The latter became so used to being relieved that it wasn't even able to decide on waste removal. I am sure that the UNMIC can do it better, but we have to think of what will happen when they leave. The cooperation between NGOs and the local administration proves to the locals that creative cooperation with the authorities as well as the procedural enforcement of democracy are not futile activities. The absence of such cooperation causes misunderstandings because the administration is unaware of what is going on in the area. As a result, the chaos increases and normality is yet further away. Point 5. Let us foster the spirit of initiative. The same pertains to the cooperation of international organizations with local NGOs. Each external organization engaging in activities on the site of a humanitarian tragedy should treat the local NGOs not only as partners, but also as a valuable investment. We have to remember that once we leave a given country, the local organizations will stay behind and continue the work we have initiated. The awareness that the cooperation is limited in time, and that tasks may have to be taken over at any time, forms a mobilizing factor for the local community and states the threat of developing dependence on aid. It is very easy for people to get used to the fact that others will do things for them, especially so in the case of refugees who have recently suffered the loss of families and homes. From the very start, the recipients of help should be taught responsibility and cooperation. The organization providing help should foster the spirit of initiative. Let's do it together. Let's help ourselves. Point 6. Let us create the foundation for trust. What is extremely necessary in the work of international organization is the creation of solid fundaments for peace and social trust. At the stages of both emergency and realization of development programs in areas affected by ethnic conflicts, it is necessary to support equally all civil victims of both sides of the struggle, as well as maintain a political attitude and independence of international NGO activities. Compliance with this rule is not always easy, especially when you deal with the torturers and the victims. However, the Bosnia or Kosovo experience shows that these roles are easily swapped. When the refugees from Albania returned to Kosovo, the actions undertaken by the NGOs towards the Serbs were not consistent enough to counteract the conviction that the international community supports only the Albanians. This produced a distrust towards the NGOs on the part of Serbs living in enclaves in Kosovo. For that very reason, in Sri Lanka, the PHO has chosen a location on the east coast where the Sinhalese and the Tamils live, creating a real ethnic and religious mix. Assistance was delivered to all people, and at least at the start it served to calm down the moods. The former enemies found themselves in the same situation. When lives had to be rescued, as the tsunami hit the coast, people saved each other no matter what ethnic group or religious. It is our task now to strengthen this tendency. 7. Mutual understanding helps. Another indispensable element of the work of the humanitarian organization is the mutual understanding and proximity between those providing and those receiving help. NGOs encounter substantial obstacles in their work in post-conflict areas in the form of different cultural setting or the inability to speak the language or understand local customs. It is vital that in our work we abandon our preconceptions on the needs of a given community and face the existing problems instead. We cannot simply translate the models of activity employed in our own countries, but adapt the type of assistance and the mode of work to the local circumstances. The NGO's competence is not the outcome of their earlier work in the other countries, but rather their ability to open up the new local conditions. Our work should consist mainly in creating stable foundation for returning to normality. We should also foster the development of local initiative and local NGOs and support the latter by sharing our experiences. 8. Let us narrow the distance. The presence of international agencies and NGOs in areas affected by conflicts or tragedies has many advantages and maybe have a positive effect on the development of a given country, provided, however, that there is no huge gap between the helpers and the helped. On occasion, the NGO presence may actually threaten the assistant and retard the natural mechanism of development of a given country. This is especially the case when the only reason for presence is that such presence is in fashion. After the Kosovo conflict in 1999, it was over 1,000 organizations concentrated mainly in Pristina, capital, and in Prizren, the very beautiful old town. With the scene so overcrowded, the only thing that matters is short-term activity itself, not the people and their future. The organization's main problem is how to feed the people and provide them with quick, temporary shelter and how to spend money fast enough. For example, in Great Britain, it is necessary to spend the money collected in a given year to avoid making profit on deposits. As a result, they have enormous problem now spending the money on tsunami victims. Such an approach reduces people to digestive systems and roofs. There is no talk, then, of corruption, which often accompanies humanitarian aid. No talk how horrible such treatment humiliates the people we want to help, even to the point of depriving them of humanity. Poverty is not only a matter of food and shelter. And hunger that we talk about and intend to alleviate by sending some food here and there is only the tip of the iceberg. The term hunger implies horrible living conditions, diseases, illiteracy, violence, family breakdown, loosening of social ties, no future, and lack of productivity. The salaries and social conditions of the employees of international NGOs are far removed from those of post-conflict countries, which creates a distance between those providing and receiving help. The differences are understandable. This distance, however, accounts for the perception of organizations as good anchors that simply give and not as partners one needs to adapt to. As a result, the demands of the beneficiaries grow and there is virtually no possibility of the emergence of local initiative. 9. We are the only for a while. Local communities, authorities and NGOs can be made responsible and prepared for the shaping of their own reality after the disaster or tragedy. Obviously, that outside means and expertise are very helpful, but it is the local people themselves that know what is best for them. Hence, from the very start, we need to entice their will to act and their sense of responsibility by offering respect, understanding, and partnership. Our role consists in helping to build solid fundamentals for peace, restoring normal life conditions after disasters, enabling the recreation of tools allowing people to become independent, and building social trust. We, the employees of humanitarian organizations, have to remember that we are here only for a while, even if a while means a couple of years. And 10. Humanitarian aid is aimed in re-establishing the proper functioning of all constituents of the socio-economic infrastructure in areas affected by a crisis or disaster. This goal cannot be achieved without the existence of civic society. This is especially important in countries where the sense of responsibility and social activity, voluntary included, has never existed or has been destroyed by totalitarian systems. I believe that each one of us is capable of working miracles and that we ourselves shape the world we live in. By good deeds, we can repair the evil we have done. We have enormous forces at our disposal, and we can use them to make this world a better place. This is what I want you all to start doing. Let us think of what we can give to each other. Let us think of what we all can do to eradicate the huge differences between the affluent North and the poor South. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, I'm going to try to be brief. I've spent most of my adult life doing human rights work, including 5 years as Deputy Secretary General of Amnesty International in London. Like a lot of human rights activists, I've spent almost none of my adult life doing humanitarian work. And yet I find myself more and more speaking on panels like this where you have both humanitarian aid workers and human rights workers together. And that's because there is a growing convergence between human rights work and humanitarian work. A lot of people are worried, actually, about this convergence, or at least some people are worried about the convergence between human rights and humanitarian work. They fear, I think, that human rights will interject ingredients into humanitarian work that will actually damage it, that will take it away from its value of neutrality, take it away from its value of ethics, and take it on a path of confrontation with governments that will, in the end, destroy humanitarian work. My fear is that human rights is not learning enough from humanitarian work. My concern is that humanitarian work should more and more take over human rights work. And I'm going to try to explain what I mean by that. I think that most of the people, like David Reif, who are worried that humanitarianism will be contaminated by human rights, are worried not about human rights, really, but by a particular form of human rights work, which has become prominent, but which is increasingly inadequate to achieve the objectives that all human rights activists have. I think that understood properly, both humanitarian work and human rights work have the same roots. They share the same values. They're fighting the same enemies. And they need each other if that fight is going to be won. First of all, it's very clear from the 10 principles that you just laid out that both human rights and humanitarian work are rooted in the same essential moral values that transcend political divisions and national boundaries. The supreme value of human dignity, which you lifted up, and the ideal of human solidarity, the imperative to reduce suffering and ensure freedom. In both cases, with humanitarianism and with human rights, the power of those values, of those ideals, has been enhanced by the fact that they have been turned into law. In the case of humanitarianism, you have the laws of war, and in the case of human rights, you, of course, have international human rights law. But these are laws that, for the most part, can only be enforced by the force of public opinion. There's no other means, no other mechanisms to really effectively enforce these laws. And that means that both humanitarian work and human rights work is dependent upon the ability to mobilize public concern and public worry. And we see that all the time, of course, that what makes governments act in the case of a tsunami, what actually got George Bush finally out of his home in Crawford to make a statement, was the growing concern of the people when they saw what was going on around the world as a result of that disaster. The demand, the people wanting to send money to do something to help. And it's the same with human rights violations. What makes, gives meaning to these rhetoric, to these declarations that you cited, is the force of public opinion. Also, both humanitarianism and human rights have the same starting point, and that's the suffering of individual human beings. Like humanitarian groups whose driving force has been to keep individuals who have been deprived of food or deprived of housing because of war or famine, to keep those people alive, the first concern of human rights groups like Amnesty International when it began in 1961 was to keep alive and free particular individuals, particularly those who called prisoners of conscience or those who were in danger of being tortured or being executed. Now, usually human rights groups could not get as close to those individuals who were being held in prison as humanitarian groups can get close to the people that they're trying to help. But the concern was basically the same. It was a concern to make sure that those people were not forgotten, to make sure that those people were given the dignity of having their names known, of having their stories known. It was to give the history of those people to the rest of the world, to let people know about them. We even went so far when we began work to have what we called adoption groups, which would actually adopt these individuals, so that you would think of the person as a member of your family rather than as some object of pity or some person who had some terrible affliction. We also had to develop techniques to help these people. We couldn't build houses. We couldn't feed these people. They were in prison. So we had to develop other techniques to try to free them. And that was, of course, the main technique that was built was documenting and reporting on their situation, trying to generate publicity through the famous Human Rights Report. And we became expert at gathering information about the violation of human rights specifically, about specific individuals, and publicizing those reports so that people could be freed. To do that work effectively, we also had to come up with the same set of principles that you just mentioned in your report. It was our goal to free real human beings. That meant that we could not afford, for the sake of rhetoric or for the sake of sensation or for the sake to exaggerate their situation or for the sake of feeling good about ourselves, to use violent language against the governments that held them. We had to persuade those governments. We had to try to dialogue with those governments in order that they would be persuaded to let people go. Impartiality and credibility were the only weapons that the human rights movement had. And it was absolutely essential to be able to demonstrate in practice that we were applying the same values to all governments, that we were acting in the same way with all sides of a conflict. What I'm trying to emphasize is that what was essential is that there were lives at stake. And because of that, everything else that we did was geared towards trying to free that individual, including making compromises with governments. We were ready to have dialogue and write polite letters to governments that were barbaric and inhuman, but to use polite language to write them, because the goal was to free the individual. It was highly frustrating work, just like the work that we've just had described, because just like humanitarian workers who save 100 children while they watch another 1,000 who starve, we would free some prisoners while others were being imprisoned. And there was never a moment when there wasn't a temptation to start to think, this is really inadequate, this work. Why are we not trying to overthrow the government rather than persuade the government to release a few of its prisoners? But nonetheless, the human rights movement kept at it, filled with the kind of ideals that we've just heard. And it turned out to be a remarkably successful method, far more than anybody could have imagined, certainly far more than its detractors ever thought. And that it could, by focusing and highlighting and publicizing the fate of certain individuals, actually lead to movements that would delegitimize those governments that were oppressing those people, bring them down, we could sweep away walls, we could end oppressive systems through the use of human rights. And it was the very success of the movement that began to undermine the movement, because it actually began to move away from the very principles that you've just heard outlined that are being reinvented and rediscovered through humanitarian work. As the movement grew in strength, it grew more professional. The notion that human rights belong to everybody in this room and that everybody in this room has as much responsibility as anyone else to protect and promote and fight for human rights began to be replaced by the idea that human rights really belonged to the experts, to the people who studied human rights, to the professionals who did human rights work, like me. They didn't belong to everyone else. And if you wanted to support human rights, what you should do is send a contribution to me or to my organization. It became a field, a particular career. It began to seem, in fact, like a kind of special interest group rather than something that represented the aspirations of all humanity. And just about that time, the human rights movement also began to have to confront, like the humanitarian movement, some new threats to human dignity that were much more difficult to confront than the problem, as difficult as it was, of people being imprisoned for their beliefs. There was, first of all of the problems associated with what now is called globalization, increasing inequality, increasing problems of an awareness of the problems of hunger, extreme poverty, and so on. The human rights movement, which had always had in its declarations and in its statements economic, social, and cultural rights that dealt with those problems, had never really worked on those problems, had no idea how you could treat hunger as a human rights violation, how you could address poverty as a human rights violation. But it became increasingly clear that those were the problems that many communities felt were the real threat to their dignity, not simply political imprisonment and political repression. And second of all, there was the threat posed by internal conflicts, massive human rights violations resulting from internal conflicts. This was the really most alarming wake-up call for the human rights movement and also tended to threaten to overwhelm humanitarian groups. Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, Chechnya, and the list now goes on and on, Colombia, Afghanistan, Iraq. These are not problems where what we needed to do was document that there was something terrible going on. Everybody knew there was something terrible going on. All you had to do was turn on CNN, and you could actually have coming into your living room pictures of people being abused, pictures of people, refugees, massive refugees fleeing from Kosovo. The problem was not documenting and reporting. The problem was what to do. What could anybody do about this? It seemed totally inadequate to simply issue a report. It seemed totally inadequate to simply write polite letters to the government saying this needs to stop. And those humanitarian groups that were trying to deal with it seemed overwhelmed by the scale of the problems and the violations. And you add to that, of course, the problem of terrorism, which is yet another dimension to the new threats that are being faced. Faced with that kind of overwhelming situation, the natural tendency for both humanitarian relief groups, I think, and human rights groups was to look to those who did have the power to stop these violations. And that's governments, but not all governments, primarily governments in the West. And the interesting thing was, because of the success of human rights and in the 80s and in early 90s, there were governments in the West who were quite happy to begin to adopt the language of human rights for what they were doing. And one government in particular was spectacular about using human rights as the kind of description of its foreign policy. And that government, of course, is the one where we are sitting today, the United States of America. And that posed a real threat to human rights. Actually, that, in my view, posed a threat to the very idea of human rights, because it seemed to say that human rights workers and humanitarian workers were actually not these impartial people who were just, expressing values, but were actually instruments of one superpower, or at best several superpowers, that were using this language as they pursued other objectives. So you had the very difficult situation of human rights groups and humanitarian groups seeing bombs being dropped in the name of humanitarianism and in the name of human rights. I just mentioned quickly that in the case of the United States, there's a particular problem with the way that it uses human rights and humanitarianism to justify what it does, which is that the United States in general has demonstrated its unwillingness to have international laws applied to itself, particularly international human rights law. The United States has a long tradition of not letting other countries monitor the United States, while the United States has very aggressively used human rights to criticize and justify its actions with other countries. And that's what I mean by a threat to the very idea of human rights, because that begins to discredit people on the ground. What do we do about this problem? Well, we have to go back to the very list of principles that was just enunciated here today. We cannot get away now from the problem of having to confront the kinds of problems that can only be solved really through government policies. It's not enough anymore just to think that we can pick off individual by individual oppression. We have to begin to figure out a way to work with governments, to push governments to do what they ought to do without appearing to have abandoned the very principles and values. In fact, we have to lift up those principles and values more than we ever did. Make it clear that our only concern is the individual human being, not particular ideologies, not particular politics. Secondly, we have to make it clear that because our concern is the human being, we don't believe that any human being, any set of human beings, can be sacrificed because it's believed that that will later produce some beneficial event. What that means is that methods have to be used that will not cause casualties now in the name of saving something in the future. And that has implications for two very important policy problems that we face. One is sanctions. One of the tools that people throw up to try to get governments to do what they should do is to impose economic sanctions on them. And we have seen now repeatedly that the destruction in terms of the kinds of lives that have been described here that can be caused by sanctions can be far greater than that caused by military intervention. In Iraq, you can have a debate about how many millions of people, of children, were killed because of sanctions on Iraq, but it seems indisputable to me that there were hundreds of thousands of deaths that resulted from sanctions. I think whatever else we agree on, we have to have a principle that that is not a way we can go. You cannot advance human rights by massively violating human rights. And that also raises, and I'll stop here, the final problem, which is the problem of war, the problem of military intervention. It has to be very tempting, both for human rights people, but also for humanitarian relief people who can't get access, for example, to threatened populations, to want to have the intervention, a military intervention. And we've seen repeated calls for military intervention. The problem is that war is a particular kind of use of force. In a war, soldiers try to win. I think there is a role, and I think there has to be an increasing role for the use of force in situations of massive humanitarian catastrophe and certainly of conflict. But I don't think military force is the way to go. I think we have to begin to think about police force. Because the difference between soldiers and policemen is that soldiers are trying to win a war. Policemen are trying to restore order and to bring to justice those who are violating order. Now, that's very simplistic, and I think a lot of thought has to go into how to do that. But I think it's a very important distinction. There's a difference between a war on terrorism and efforts to bring to justice those who have committed acts of terror. It's a huge difference, I think. If we argue that there can be no force at all, then we leave relief workers and innocent people as helpless victims. If we argue that there should be military intervention without any thought about what that means, we may end up with greater human rights disasters than we ever had before. So there has to be some effort to begin to think through how to find a mechanism for getting protection that won't cause a destruction of values. And the last point I'll make is the one about impartiality, the one that you also made. It's absolutely essential that both humanitarian and independence, I would say, that both humanitarian work and human rights work assert, again, its independence from all governments and its impartiality to all governments. And that includes, in particular, and here is the responsibility on the people in this room is particularly strong, because that means holding all governments, including the United States of America, to the same standard that other governments are held. And we are living in a country where that is not happening, where the United States does not allow itself to be held to those standards, where domestically it doesn't even think about human rights in terms of its own healthcare system, in terms of its own poverty. You won't hear people talk about human rights standards when those problems are discussed. It's absolutely essential if human rights and humanitarian relief is to continue to have and express the kind of ideals that we heard tonight, that we reassert impartiality. I think I'll stop there.
You've been listening to a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University. Tonight's discussion was on issues and challenges facing humanitarian aid and development assistance in today's world. Speaking was Janina Ochojska, president and founder of the Polish Humanitarian Organization, and Larry Cox, senior program officer, Human Rights and International Cooperation Unit, Ford Foundation. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skoll and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.